got my mojo working, but it just don't work on you. Got my mojo working, but it just don't work on you. I wanna love you so bad till I don't know what to do. I'm going down in Louisiana too.
Got my mojo working, Muddy Waters. Born on this day in 1913, one of the greats. So that's part of our day in history, Muddy Waters. Now, another part of our day in history was the tragic and assassination of Martin Luther King that took place on this day. And a year before that day, we played part of the speech at the very top of the hour on our program, the speech he gave about the war in Vietnam. And that happened on this day as well, a year before he was assassinated. We are joined now by the Reverend Brad Braxton, Program Officer, Religion in the Public Sphere at the Ford Foundation. And here in Baltimore, he's Senior Pastor of the Open Church. Dr. Peniel Joseph, who just appeared with us to talk about his book, Stokely a Life and Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America. He's a professor of history at Tufts University. And Peniel and Brad, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good to hear your voices. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. You know, Peniel, there's so many aspects of this. I want to start with you because the conversation we just had about your book, Stokely a Life, one of the things that was revealed in that book was the intense relationship that Stokely Carmichael had with Martin Luther King that most people didn't know about. I think I know I wasn't aware of the depth of it. Many people who were involved in that era were not aware of the depth of it until your book. But I talk about what that means in terms of which, reflecting on Martin Luther King and his politics, where he came to, and what interactions like he had with people like Stokely and Bayard did for his political change and growth over the years.
Well, yeah, I think one of Dr. King's best attributes is that not only clearly does he articulate this vision, this expansive vision for American democracy and world transformation, social justice, he really listens to people as well. So part of his growth as a leader is going to be listening to other voices, even when he disagrees with aspects of what they're saying. So what you see clearly with King is going to be real growth and maturity. As the 60s progress, instead of doubling down on what he was doing before, he actually becomes a much more muscular and vocal critic of American society and what he's going to describe as American imperialism, and certainly listening to voices like Stokely Carmichael, Bayard Rustin in the 1950s when he was in Montgomery, Alabama, giving him a clearer understanding of what nonviolence was, not to have any armed men outside of his door. But certainly Stokely's criticism of the Vietnam War fuses into what I call King's last campaign, his last crusade, which is connecting the war in Vietnam with a larger anti-poverty agenda and wealth redistribution agenda, which he clearly is articulating during the last year of his life.
And Brad, I keep great to hear your voice again. It's been too long.
Yes.
Congratulations on your new position.
Thank you.
But I'd like to, I'm very curious what you have been reflecting on when it comes to King, both as you work as a minister and as a social activist.
Actually, I'd like to pick up where Dr. Joseph left off. Appreciate him leading us there. One of the profound realities of the last years of Dr. King's life is this intensification, as Dr. Joseph has indicated, of his more radical prophetic edge. And I think we must take into consideration the material history, the sociological aspects of that. And by that, I mean the stint that Dr. King spent in the ghetto on the north side of Chicago and the reflections that are captured very nicely in Taylor Branch's trilogy of how that moment in Chicago took away perhaps some of the earlier optimism. It induced a new kind of realism that, in fact, perhaps the northern version of racism and classism, that version was even more intractable than that which he had seen in the South, which is quite a mouthful to say given all that was going on in the South. And I think seeing that reality helped him to recognize how multidimensional were these strands of oppression, which, as Dr. Joseph rightly indicated, helped him to then continue to think about the global aspects, what was going on in Vietnam, what was happening in South African apartheid. Of course, the overtures he took from Gandhi's great post-colonial struggle or anti-colonial struggle in India. So that particular moment in Chicago, I think, did something very powerful to Dr. King. And I raise that because here we are these many years later looking at Chicago, the third largest city in our country, and it's no different than New York or Baltimore and many other places, and the continued violence and the continued intensification of poverty that we see. And I think Dr. King would go to those cities, and like Jesus over Jerusalem in Jesus' last days, Dr. King would weep over these cities.
What you both said makes me think of a kind of arc here and what it might mean for where we are today, because what you were just describing, Brad, King was at a point before he died where he had led the charge to defeat what I will call racial terrorism in the South. Because black folks in the South lived under virtual terrorism, and especially in the deepest part of the South, but all through the South. And then, as you just described, his kind of look at what he saw in terms of class and racism in the North, and beginning the Poor People's Campaign, and beginning to reflect deeply about the question of imperialism and the economic system and wealth distribution, there was a new kind of King rising. And I wonder what this says to us now, given where the issue of race and racism come, which is the issue of extreme wealth in America. What does this tell us, do you think, today? What is it saying to us for now? What does this legacy of King that we're just describing here speak to in 2014?
Well, I think the biggest thing is what Dr. King saw and other activists saw, black power activists saw this as well in the 1960s, was that the measure of civil rights progress, broadly speaking, was going to be played out on economic battlefields, both domestically and internationally. So it was going to be about the measure of wealth inequality between the global North and the global South, and then in the United States, the measure of wealth inequality or economic justice between whites, Latinos, blacks, Native Americans, the whole multicultural landscape. And so the reason why the Poor People's March and the Poor People's Campaign is so revolutionary is that King decides to wage a camp in right at the nation's capital to really humiliate the federal government, to attract attention to the fact that this is the richest country in the world in 1967-68, and there's this endemic poverty. But what he does, which upsets even more people, he brings a multicultural hue to Washington, D.C. So he brings whites from Appalachia. He brings Native Americans from reservations. He brings Mexicans from the Southwest. He brings blacks from Sparks, Mississippi. And that was all. He brings people from Harlem. That was designed to really psychologically punish the United States. And show them that the rhetoric of democracy and equality were nothing more than lies and hypocrisy, the same kind of hypocrisy Malcolm X had articulated. So what's interesting is that 50 years later, because it's 46 years after his death today, the economic battlefields that King knew were so relevant to measuring civil rights progress are worse now than they were 46 years ago for the majority of Americans. So this is not for certain black folks who are now billionaires or millionaires. But the majority of African Americans, the majority of the people who King was protesting on behalf are in a worse position now than they were 46 years ago. And this is the same globally because of globalization and neoliberalism. So, and I think that, you know, the Reverend's right. King would have wept, but King would have also spoken truth to power. And he would have lost access to the Obama White House, just like he lost access to the Lyndon Johnson White House. He would have lost access to the people who feted him when he won the Nobel Prize in '64, and then demonized him when he spoke out against Vietnam. Because King, not in the black community, but in the majority community, it's important to know that King was demonized and denigrated and despised as a traitor and as an un-American subversive, even by people like Ralph Bunche. This happened. We praise him after he died. But when he was alive, people said he was just as bad as Stokely Carmichael because he was willing to talk about American imperialism and racism and talk about the way in which capitalism distorts and destroys and defames aspects of American democracy, and people didn't want to hear that.
That's very powerful for Neil. Brad?
I think the arc of which you speak, Mark, helps us to understand what it means to be a genuine patriot. We often talk about Dr. King as a prophet, and indeed there is much to say in that regard. But Dr. King was a genuine patriot. He showed us over and over again what, if you'll allow me to say it this way, a true patriot act looks like, right? So the true patriot act is not questionable legislation enabling a government to eavesdrop on innocent citizens. A true patriot act is the clarion call for a government to do right by its citizens and the citizens of the world. And so King talked about, much to what Dr. Joseph was saying, this notion of speaking truth to power. And here's the piece that I will also add to that. We often talk about speaking truth to power, but in order to speak truth to power, you must know what the truth is.
Yeah.
And Dr. King had a profound sense of the ultimate truth was that God is watching and that we must ultimately answer to a God who is deeply committed not only to justice, but also to love. And this is one of the points I constantly, as an activist myself, say to other activists, as important as justice is always penultimate. There is something beyond justice, and it is love. Love, and that's the fundamental piece King was struggling for, even in terms of the Poor People's Campaign. It was a kind of earthly pulling together of what he, as preacher and theologian, hoped would be in some manifestation in God's great future, right? This beloved community. So love is what I think he would ultimately emphasize even today. Love is the ultimate impulse of the cosmos.
You know, I was thinking when you said that, Brad, and what we both just said, that as someone who lived in Resurrection City in 1968, what you talk about love, there were a lot of issues with Resurrection City, especially with some of the leadership at the time. But in the camp itself, that existed crossing racial lines.
Yes.
It was amazing to watch. People lived in different camps. Native people had their little camp, and folks in Mississippi and Chicago had their little camps, and we were part of a little camp of people from Appalachian folks from Chicago and from Kentucky, West Virginia, Mississippi, Alabama. But it was the camaraderie and love that happened between those camps. It was amazing on that day. And I wonder, you know, we have to take a break here in about 2 minutes, but maybe I'll ask you guys to stay on for just 5 minutes longer before we start our sports show to kind of reflect on where you think in King's legacy that crossing these lines of race and class, what do you think actually can happen in America, given both your perspectives, both as a historian and as a spiritual leader, what you think can really cross in creating a new movement in this country? Is that possible at this point? What do you think, Peniel? I mean, we got about 2 minutes left before we have to take a break. Is that right? Yeah? Give us a quick thought, but we'll come right back to you.
Well, yeah, we can build that multiracial, multi-class movement. But part of it is that we have to talk about the terrain of race and class and gender justice.
Right.
Think about things like mass incarceration. When we think about the public school to prison pipeline, all these things intersect, the unemployment rates, with race, class, and gender. Right now, everybody is being economically abused in the United States, but disproportionately the face of that abuse and that oppression is an African-American face, and we can't forget that. Yet at the same time, we have to connect with these other citizens in terms of people who are people of color, poor whites, people who are, you know, women, and also people in terms of sexuality as well. For this massive movement for economic justice, Dr. King would have definitely been for that transracial, trans-class movement, but he would have talked about the way in which race is very central because the face of that poverty is racialized.
So we're going to take a very brief break here. We're going to come right back. We're only going to take a few more minutes because our sports guys are here and we have a lot to talk about. We can get them in on a different set of conversation. We're going to go out here with an appropriate song, the Mississippi Delta Blues, by the late, great, wonderful Muddy Waters. This today is the day of his birth. Stay with us. Distance phone, Muddy Waters, born on this day. So we're going to just complete in the next few minutes here our conversation with Dr. Peniel Joseph and the Reverend Brad Braxton about Martin Luther King. And we heard what Peniel was saying, just very quickly, to just reflect on how that movement could happen in America today in light of King's life.
Absolutely. Brad? In conclusion, I would say, I would think Dr. King would definitely reflect on his own complicity in one glaring piece we don't talk a lot about, and that is the way in which the movement did not valorize women. We know how important the voices and strategy and thinking and courage of women were in that movement and girls. And I think that is one of the pieces that we need to continue to talk about, is the way in which so many institutions around the world are always sacrificing women in one way or another. That would be one thing. I think he would be very reflective upon that. The second thing I think he would call us for, a constant agitation for more inclusive, more humane public policies alongside the prophetic transformation of our public values, values that continue to valorize the human spirit. For nothing brings more glory to God than when a human being is fully alive.
I'm going to thank both of you, and I really want you two to be more of a presence on the show in the coming months and years, because you two have so much important to say, I think, to our listeners. And the stuff that you write and work in, that was Reverend Brad Braxton, now Program Officer of Religion in the Public Sphere at the Ford Foundation and Senior Pastor here in Baltimore at the Open Church, a church he founded here in Baltimore. And Dr. Peniel Joseph, a professor of history at Tufts, who's written this book, I recommend to everybody now, Stokely, A Life, broke new ground in Stokely Carmichael's life in terms of what his real presence meant in the Civil Rights Movement and in America. And, of course, his previous book, Waiting Until the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, which also is a incredible book. And so, Peniel and Brad, thank you both so much for taking your time today with our listeners.
Hey, thank you.
Good to be with you.
We're going to come out for just 2 seconds. We're going to hear a little bit of Hugh Masekela, Graze in the Grass. This is Hugh Masekela's birthday, and come back to Graze on some sports. Stay with us.